isn't scientifically reliable. At what point does the year-long window in which Johnny had to file his petition begin to take effect? Should it be after the first critical study? The second? Is it once the scientific community has reached a consensus? What defines a consensus? How does one define the field of scientists among which such a consensus must arise? It isn't as if scientists take an annual vote on these things. These are critical questions, and they're essentially impossible to answer. The courts and Congress have set a trap for these defendants, and absent DNA evidence, there's really no escaping it. File your claim too soon, say after the first few studies, and the courts could rule that you haven't presented enough evidence that the expertise used to convict you has been discredited. You now risk being barred from ever raising the issue again. But if you wait for a stronger scientific consensus before filing, the courts could rule that your deadline passed a year after those first few studies were published. Your window has closed. Here, too, you're now barred from raising that claim again. And that's all just for the suspect fields of forensics. With individual experts, it gets even trickier. Michael West is a good example. Mississippi's courts, prosecutors, and attorneys continued to uphold and defend West's credibility well into the mid-2000s, despite the fact he had been repeatedly criticized and exposed going back to the mid-1990s. As previously noted, Mississippi Attorney General Jim Hood finally conceded in 2008 that West wasn't a credible witness, telling the Jackson Free Press that West is someone we have investigated and I don't support him in any manner. But while Hood's office had by then stopped explicitly defending the substance of West's analyses in court, his office still continues to defend convictions won primarily on West's testimony. Instead of arguing that West is a credible witness, the office now argues that defendants are procedurally barred from raising West as an issue again because most of them already challenged West's credibility and lost. It doesn't matter that even Hood acknowledges now that the courts back then were wrong. For the purpose of challenging West in a post-conviction petition in federal court then, at what point should a defendant have known that West had been discredited? When did the one-year window begin? Was it the first time West's testimony was thrown out in the early 1990s? When he was suspended or ousted from forensics groups in the mid-1990s? Was it after the video from the early 2000s, when West erroneously matched an uninvolved individual's teeth mold to the photograph in Ray Krohn's case? Has it even happened yet? James Kuhn wasn't challenging the credibility of forensic pathology in general, but of a specific medical examiner. That's even more difficult. Forensic pathology is a particularly tricky area of forensics, because while its general precepts are widely accepted in the medical and scientific community, the line between objective and subjective opinions is often hard to discern. So is the line between informed expert opinions and opinions unsupported by science. There are four bullet holes in the victim's heart is an objective statement. Rarely will two medical examiners argue over such a point. The bullet's trajectory suggests that the killer shot the victim while standing is far more subjective. It may be true, but it's confounded by variables. There were two hands on the gun that fired this bullet isn't valid testimony, but there are countless degrees of gradation in between. The Mississippi Supreme Court tossed Haynes' two hands on the gun testimony, but it didn't let his outrageous opinions in that case affect how it evaluated his testimony in other cases. When Haynes was subsequently challenged after Edmonds, the courts evaluated the validity of his testimony in those cases in isolation on their own merits. But why should that be? Once an expert witness has shown himself willing to give preposterous testimony, why should the court defer to him in cases where his testimony might be scientifically plausible but is still subjective? Why should the court allow future juries in murder trials to give a medical examiner whose previous testimony was found to be reversible error the same consideration they would give a medical examiner whose previous testimony has consistently shown meticulous care for accuracy. In cases in which forensic analysts have been clearly exposed as frauds, such as crime lab technicians shown to have faked test results, it's usually clear when the clock should start running on the window to file a petition for relief. It might be when the analyst was fired, or when a newspaper series or Inspector General's investigation was first published. But in cases like that of Hain, the situation is more nuanced. The information trickles out over time. The gradual discrediting of Hain took place over more than a decade. In November 2014, the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals ruled that Stephen Hain had earned the label of discredited. But exactly when did the court reach that conclusion? And how was James Coon supposed to have known? There was no announcement, there was no press release, there was no notice given to those who may have been convicted by Hain's testimony that said, "Hey, you now have 1 year to file your claims." The added indignity for someone like Coon is that Louisiana offers post-conviction indigent legal help only to those who have been sentenced to death. Coon was sentenced to life in prison, so once he lost his appeal, he lost his lawyer. He filed his post-conviction petition himself. The Fifth Circuit ruling in his case essentially states that from his prison cell, an indigent defendant like Coon should not only have been following each revelation about Hain's credibility as it happened, but should have been able to discern the precise moment when those revelations tipped the scales to make Hain discredited in the eyes of the court, even though the court itself couldn't or wouldn't say precisely when that occurred. And Coon should have then filed his petition within a year of that magical moment. But it's even worse than that. Not only do the courts expect these defendants to abide by these dizzying rules to the letter, the courts refuse to hold themselves to the same standard. The Flags ruling that affirmed Hain's credibility as an expert witness came in March 2013. That would be 19 months after July 2011, which the same court declared was the very latest by which Coon should have already discovered the evidence that Hain was not credible. There's just no way Coon could have gotten it right. Lastly, and perhaps most importantly, as this book has now thoroughly documented, this is all the more unfair given that Mississippi officials tried desperately to keep information about Hain, his autopsies, and his arrangements with the state from public view. Mississippi's open records laws are among the worst in the country. When Innocence Project attorneys requested autopsy reports from district attorneys' offices to look for other cases possibly corrupted by Hain or West, they were unanimously rejected. The criminal defense systems in both Louisiana and Mississippi are also underfunded and overworked. Even if Coon had an attorney, the idea that a lawyer appointed to a capital case and handed a $1,500 check should or could have spent hours looking into Hain's credentials, researching his background, fighting with state officials to see how many autopsies he'd done, and soliciting other forensic pathologists to review his work, sometimes with no additional funding from the court, has never jibed with reality. Even if an intrepid attorney were willing and able to take all of that on, the simple fact of the matter is that the courts had qualified Hain as an expert witness thousands of times. Though he was often challenged, no trial judge ever refused to let him testify. Not a single time. At some point, it becomes clear that any attorney who spends hours and hours chasing down material in an effort to discredit this particular expert would be doing a disservice to his client. That time would be better spent on matters more likely to have an impact on the case. Moreover, the notion that the defendants in such cases would now be punished for their attorney's failure to investigate or challenge Hain, a failure that the courts also consistently ruled did not rise to the level of ineffective assistance of counsel anyway, is anathematic to any concept of justice. And it's all the worse for those inmates who didn't have an attorney to help with their appeals. Coon was convicted based on testimony from an expert that the Fifth Circuit now considers discredited. For the same court to nevertheless uphold his conviction because he missed a deadline he had no way of knowing existed, is yet another example of keeping a person in prison on a technicality. The fact that the ruling in Kuhn wasn't necessarily wrong under the law is only more evidence that the system values process far more than justice. Finally, it's worth noting that the discredited acknowledgement in the ruling did not prevent Hain from testifying in future cases in the Fifth Circuit or anywhere else. It did not prevent Louisiana prosecutors from using him if they so desired, or even Mississippi prosecutors should the state change its laws. Ironically, or perhaps not, the only real consequence of the Fifth Circuit's acknowledgement that a longtime expert witness for the state was now discredited was to prevent criminal defendants from challenging that expert in federal court. For years, Stephen Hain had claimed that he wasn't certified by the American Board of Pathology, ABP, because he found the test questions insulting and walked out. For years, the courts bought that line. He wrote it to an appointment as the interim state medical examiner, aided by his claims to be certified by a number of other less accepted groups. It took a while, but in 2012, a more plausible explanation finally emerged. Back in 2008, the Clarion Ledger had contacted the ABP to inquire about the exam Hain took in 1989. I pulled the text of this examination from our files, Dr. Betsy Bennett, the group's executive director, told the paper. There was no question on that examination that was remotely similar to Dr. Hain's description. But Hain stuck to his story. He told the paper he was certain that the question was on the test. Not only that, he said he'd stake his reputation and career on it. "She is flat wrong," he said of Bennett. "She doesn't know what she's talking about. It's like remembering where you were when men landed on the moon." In a deposition 4 years later, Hain was confronted with a copy of the exam provided by the ABP. There was no colors of death question. When asked why for 2 decades he had peddled the story about storming out over a bogus question, Hain posited that perhaps more than one test had been given that year. The ABP said this wasn't the case, before finally saying he had no explanation. If Hain did walk out, as he claimed, his scores offer an explanation why. At the time he quit, Hain was failing every section of the test. On every section, he was in the bottom decile of test takers. According to the American Board of Pathology, about 80% of candidates pass the exam on the first try. Hain has never really explained why he didn't just try to take the test again. Perhaps he felt it was beneath him. Perhaps he wasn't sure he could pass it. Instead, he continued to testify about his certifications as he always had. He got away with it for 20 years. Within just the last few years, more challenges to Hain and West have come before appellate courts. Several are cases in which Hain and West have introduced to the criminal justice system ever more novel methods of forensic analysis. In one such case, the murder trial of John Ross, the two men fired bullets they had made themselves into freshly harvested canine skins in an attempt to boost the prosecution's theory that a woman had been murdered by her husband and hadn't committed suicide as her husband had claimed. The two experts testified that when they replicated the powder burns seen on the woman's head on the dog skins, the gun was 2 to 3 inches from the skins, a distance more consistent with homicide than suicide. Ross was convicted. But only 4 in 5 gun suicides are from that distance, meaning there was still a 20% chance this wasn't a murder. Hain also claimed in his testimony that women shoot themselves in the chest instead of the head at a rate of 4-5 to 1. But the research on women, guns, and suicide doesn't ultimately support Hain's contention. In fact, One expert on guns and suicide has said not only that there's no scientific evidence to support the notion, but that the notion itself is based on a sexist assumption that women are vain and don't want to leave behind a disfigured corpse. And yet the verdict was upheld on appeal. Perhaps the oddest Hayne case to hit the appellate courts in recent years involves his use of a death mask. Joseph Osborne was accused of killing his girlfriend's son in 2002 by smothering the boy as he slept. The family initially believed that the boy had died after accidentally ingesting some drugs. But after an autopsy, Hayne concluded that the cause of death was murder by suffocation. 5 months later, the boy's young brother gave some information in a police interview that was vaguely incriminating of Osborne. The authorities exhumed the boy's body and took it to Hayne for a second look. Hayne requested the services of a forensic odontologist, this time someone other than Michael West, who created a plaster cast, a death mask, according to Hayne's terminology, of the boy's face. Hayne then marked on the mask the sites of injury that purportedly corresponded with previous marks he'd made on his autopsy diagram. From all of this, Hayne claimed that he could determine the approximate size of the hand that inflicted the injuries. He said his calculations were consistent with the size of Joseph Osborne's hand. At trial, Hayne testified that the boy was suffocated and that his injuries were consistent with an adult person having covered the child's nose and mouth with a hand. He further declared that his death mask demonstrated that it was a large hand, which would favor a male's hand that caused the child's injuries. When asked by the New York Times in 2013 to comment on Hayne's testimony, Dr. Andrew M. Baker, a previous president of the National Association of Medical Examiners, and the chief medical examiner for Hennepin County, Minnesota, told the paper, "I saw a very similar case like that on Law and Order SVU. I've never heard of it in real life." Baker said not only was the technique itself unprecedented, so was the ability to speculate from those sorts of wounds about hand size or gender. Interestingly, the prosecutor in the case preemptively explained to the judge that Hayne was no Michael West, and that the death mask technique was in no way as ridiculous as West's ultraviolet light technique. The judge allowed the death mask testimony, and after 6 hours of deliberation, the jury found Osborne guilty of depraved heart murder. His conviction was then affirmed by the state's appellate courts. By the time both John Ross and Joseph Osborne went back to court in 2014, Hayne and West had come under fire. The Mississippi Supreme Court also seemed to finally be giving more scrutiny to expert testimony. It had recently overturned a number of verdicts because of witness statements it had ruled were scientifically unreliable. In one case, the court even reminded trial judges that their gatekeeping duty under Daubert includes making sure that the opinions themselves are based on sufficient facts or data and are the product of reliable principles and methods. The timing seemed right, and yet the Mississippi Supreme Court refused to grant either defendant relief. Without addressing the merits of the claims in either case, the majority wrote only that any evidence about Hayne or West was reasonably discoverable at the time of trial, and that even if it had been barred at trial, it would not have caused a different result in the conviction or sentence. There is one critical difference between cases like Osborne and Ross and those in which the Mississippi Supreme Court had recently been more skeptical of expert testimony. The other cases were civil cases. The other cases pitted two private parties against one another. In those cases, both parties had access to devoted and competent counsel, or even entire firms, who had taken the cases voluntarily and were presumably handling manageable caseloads. In those cases, the court was deciding between two private parties, not between the state and the criminally accused. The parties who mounted the challenges to expert testimony in such cases also tended to be large companies that were being sued. That meant they had more resources to support those challenges, but in a conservative state, the justices also had some political cover should they decide to uphold them. A vote to throw out the unscientific evidence in a criminal case could result in an overturned conviction. It could anger state officials, and it could subject the justices who voted that way to attack ads when they were up for re-election. In fact, legal scholars have consistently pointed out that Daubert challenges are far more likely to be successful in civil cases than in criminal cases. This despite the fact that in criminal cases the consequences of a verdict tainted by junk science are obviously quite a bit more profound. John Ross had no more luck in federal court. Like the Mississippi Supreme Court, the federal district court found that he should have discovered the existing criticisms of Hayne and West before his trial. At the end of the day, the court's refusal to grant a new trial in these cases is understandable. Still outrageous, but understandable. On some level, these defendants were asking for much more than their right to a fair trial. They were asking a court, whether the Mississippi Supreme Court or a federal court, to repudiate years, an entire era, really, of what had passed for the fair and just application of criminal law in the state of Mississippi. Every judge who considered the claims from defendants like Ross and Osborne had come of age in that era. The federal judge who denied Ross's claim had been a prosecutor for much of the 1980s and later a circuit court judge during Hayne and West's heyday. Of the 9 Mississippi Supreme Court justices at the time, only one had any extensive criminal defense experience. To the extent that the others had any, they were former prosecutors. None gained their seats because they exhibited skepticism of the criminal justice system. All were cultivators and beneficiaries of the status quo. What makes it all especially cynical, though, is that no one really believed what the courts were saying, not even the courts themselves. By the time Shannon Rayner was prosecuted for killing his wife in 2013, Hayne had already been fired and was now freelancing for defense attorneys. At Rayner's trial, Hayne not only testified for the defense, but testified in opposition to the physicians in the state medical examiner's office, an office that, for all intents and purposes, he and his supporters had worked to keep vacant. During a lunch break, Hayne and the prosecutor exchanged pleasantries. After the break, Hayne resumed his testimony. During cross-examination, the prosecutor asked Hayne, "You told me during lunch the reason you have to carry around that big notebook with you is you have to defend yourself nowadays for all the reversals you've had in the Mississippi Supreme Court. Is that correct?" Rayner's lawyer objected. The trial court overruled, finding that the question spoke to Hayne's credibility. The prosecutor proceeded to question Hayne about those former cases, including the fact that in many of them, the basis for the reversal was that Hayne had testified outside his area of expertise. In his closing argument, the prosecutor then referred to Hayne as discredited. Rayner appealed his conviction, arguing that the state's questioning of Hayne was improper, particularly given that the state was still defending Hayne's credibility in countless other cases. The Mississippi Court of Appeals didn't agree. The court found the questioning entirely proper. That was probably the correct ruling under the law, but it was also another indication that the system is utterly incapable of distinguishing good expertise from bad, and the protocols in place for making those decisions are a farce. When defense attorneys would simultaneously argue that the practice of bite mark matching was illegitimate while citing their own bite mark analysts' specific criticisms of West, the appeals court would smack their hands. You could argue one or the other, but not both. Yet they had no problem when the state of Mississippi simultaneously took the position that Stephen Hayne was both credible and not credible, depending whether he was testifying for the state or for the defense. "I'm happy," says Levon Brooks. He's sipping from a Sprite bottle filled with rum. "For the first time since I can remember, I'm happy." It's a cool afternoon in December 2015. Levon and Dinah Brooks live in a trailer home between Brooksville and Columbus. They met while he was in prison. She worked in the cafeteria. Brooks had proposed years ago, but he never seemed interested in setting a date. Dinah ribbed him for that. Behind their house, a menagerie of hunting dogs, chickens, rabbits, and other animals bark, cluck, bay, and scurry around in their coops. Friends and neighbors stop by, sometimes stay a while to chat. The place bustles with life. Most who meet Brooks are immediately struck by his presence. Ed Blake, the DNA analyst in California who worked on Brooks's and Brewer's cases, recalls the first time he met Brooks. "He's not a big man," Blake says. "There are some people that simply have a look about them that commands one's attention, and Levon Brooks is one of those individuals. He hardly has to talk to you before you're drawn to him to engage in a conversation. And then once you engage in that conversation, his charisma, his dignity simply flow." Brooks's declaration of happiness becomes all the more poignant a few minutes later when he lifts his shirt to reveal the pump that's sending chemotherapy through his body. He was diagnosed with stomach cancer in 2014. But he has good doctors in Mississippi, and the Innocence Project put him in touch with a leading oncologist in New York. His prognosis is good. On this chilly afternoon, Brooks is dressed in a t-shirt and camouflage pants, and his hair is in braids. He offers his guests some deer jerky, then shows off his new rifle. "Did you hear about Allgood?" he asks. "I campaigned for the new guy. I think I like him," he says. He flashes a Cheshire smile. When asked if he holds any resentment for the men who convicted him, Brooks points out that Allgood apologized to him on the day he was released, but the two haven't spoken since. Not that they necessarily would have been friends under different circumstances. Noxubee County is a small, close-knit community, but it's also largely segregated. So what about former Deputy Eichelberger? Has he apologized? "Not in words," Brooks says, "but he doesn't talk much. He gave me a hunting dog after I got out. I think it was his way of saying he's sorry. We hunt deer together sometimes." Within about 10 minutes of meeting Brooks, odds are pretty good that he'll ask if you'd like to go hunting with him. He just assumes you'll love it as much as he does. Since he got out, Brooks has also been on the receiving end of more than a few such invitations. One came from his old childhood friend Boswell "Boz" Stevens, the foreperson of the jury that convicted him, who lets Brooks hunt and fish on the family farm. Stevens has since come full circle. In a way, so has the plantation where he and Brooks grew up. Stevens's mother died a few years ago. Since then, the farm has been rented out to contract farmers. In an interview several years earlier, just before Christmas, Stevens pondered his role in Brooks's trial. He stood in his yard, just outside the cabin that Brooks's aunt and uncle called home, back when they were some of the last tenant workers on the farm. For certain, he said, he regretted what happened. He was happy that he and Brooks were on friendly terms again, though he wishes there were some way to make things whole. Asked to reflect on his heritage, the trial, and what had happened since, he leaned up against his pickup truck and thought for a moment. "I'm not my grandfather, I guess," he said. He added, after a pause, "and he wasn't me." Shortly after Brooks was released, Ashley Smith apologized to him, too, for identifying him as the man who abducted her sister. She didn't need to, of course. He never blamed her. Courtney Smith's father, Rocky Allen, also apologized, though he, too, had no real reason to. "It troubled me all this time," he told Brooks. Some 25 years ago, Brooks left the job he loved at the Santa Barbara Club to clear up any misunderstanding with the Noxubee County Sheriff's Department. He told his friends he'd be right back. He never returned. Now, with some of his wrongful conviction money, he's back in the entertainment business. he and Dinah opened a cafe behind his house. They named it D&T's Hill City Hideaway. The modest, cozy spot serves up fried foods, soda, and beer. Baseball caps and saggy pants aren't allowed. On Saturday afternoons, they show college football. At night, they dance. Early last summer, the Hill City Hideaway hosted a wedding, that of its owners. LeVon had finally come around. A photographer from New York who had become a good friend drove down to shoot the affair. The weather was hot. The dress was casual. Dinah wore a peach chiffon dress. LeVon wore white, head to toe, a white hat, white linen shirt, white jeans, and white leather cowboy boots. There was a lot of dancing. Michael West seems to have given up. He gave up on bite mark analysis. In 2012, he said in a deposition, "I no longer believe in bite mark analysis," and then later said to a reporter, "The science is not as exact as I had hoped." West also gave up his private dental practice. But West has hardly been chastened. In the years since the Mississippi Supreme Court's Howard decision in 2006, Eddie Lee Howard's attorneys were able to get DNA testing done on the knife allegedly used to kill Georgia Kemp. The tests revealed male DNA, but excluded Howard as the source. That meant that not only was Michael West's bite mark testimony the only physical evidence linking Howard to the crime scene, but there was also DNA from another man on the murder weapon. That wasn't enough to get Howard a new trial, but it was enough to get him an evidentiary hearing. In preparation for that hearing, Howard's attorneys with the Innocence Project deposed West in April 2016. It was a confrontation that had been years in the making, and Wes put on quite a show. During questioning by Chris Fabricant from the Innocence Project of New York, Wes was belligerent, profane, and petulant. He declined to prepare for the deposition at all. He was asked to bring reams of case records and other documents. He brought a Diet Coke, which he used to produce a loud belch before answering a question. West at first answered Fabricant's questions with pouty one-word responses, as if he were a child angry at his parents. But he soon loosened up, and those one-word answers turned into insults, defiant accusations, and meandering soliloquies. West frequently told Fabricant that he couldn't remember cases and had no interest in trying. When Fabricant asked West about the Lee Stubbs case, he replied, "Was that the case of the two lesbians that bit the girl's vagina lip off?" When Fabricant asked West about fellow bite mark analysts, people West once called colleagues, he described them with words like idiot, whore, and fool. When Fabricant continued to ask West about his testimony in old cases, West got angry. "Why are you beating me to death with this?" he demanded. "I told you if it's in the transcript, I stand by it. If I remembered it, I don't remember what the fuck I had for breakfast 2 years ago, but I do believe I ate eggs." West reiterated his belief that both LeVon Brooks and Kennedy Brewer were guilty. He speculated, as he did any time DNA testing had proven him wrong, that the tests only proved they didn't commit the rapes, not that they weren't involved. Fabricant next asked West why, in so many of his cases, he found that the assailant only bit the victim with his upper teeth. West answered, "That's funny. Y'all like to come on that," referring to the crude term for ejaculation. When the deposition finally came to a close, Fabricant asked West if he had any questions. He did. "How do you sleep at night?" West asked. Fabricant answered that he slept very well. West replied, "You're a sociopath. It's amazing to me they don't care what their clients do. They will do anything to get them off, no matter how heinous murdering their clients are. You're sitting next to a sociopath. You work for Innocence Project. Every attorney I've met with the Innocence Project lies, cheats, steals, and tries to obfuscate the evidence in front of the court. I have no respect for y'all." Fabricant replied, "I see. And so that makes me a sociopath?" West answered, No, that makes you an asswipe. You make yourself a sociopath. Thus ended the deposition. One might think that the attorneys in the Mississippi Attorney General's office would be embarrassed by the behavior of their star witness in a death penalty case. But Hood's office had no comment about West's antics, and the state even asked the trial judge for a hearing to assess the competency of Howard's legal team. It was a brazen move. The motion was based on a rule in Mississippi's Rules of Criminal Procedure. The intent behind that rule is sound. It gives the state's courts a mechanism to ensure that defendants in capital cases are getting adequate legal representation in their appeals. But the original language of the rule was vague and sloppily drafted. Hood's office had been using the rule as a weapon. While Hood and his subordinates claim in briefs that they're merely fulfilling their obligation to protect the rights of criminal defendants, they aren't filing these motions as a matter of course in every capital case. The sense in Mississippi, a notion backed up by an affidavit filed by the American Bar Association, is that they've been using the rule to hassle out-of-state law firms and nonprofit legal aid groups taking Mississippi capital cases on a pro bono basis. The attorneys at these firms and aid groups have extensive experience in capital cases. In other words, instead of using the rule to keep unqualified attorneys out of death penalty cases, Hood's office has been using the rule to attack the most qualified attorneys. In the case of Eddie Lee Howard, Hood's decision to invoke the rule when he did was the legal equivalent of trolling. The particular attorneys had already been representing Howard for years. Three of them had helped win the exonerations of Kennedy Brewer and LaVon Brooks. Moreover, less than a year earlier, Hood's office had defended the qualifications of Howard's same attorneys in response to a separate motion. A few days after Hood filed his motion, the Mississippi Supreme Court revised the rule to fix the vague language and sloppy drafting. The new language renders the motion from Hood's office moot. It isn't clear if the court's decision to revise the rule was a direct response to the state's motion, but the timing is certainly suggestive. The actual court hearing for Eddie Lee Howard followed a few months later. West was as prickly and pugnacious as ever. As of this writing, the court has yet to rule on the matter, and Eddie Lee Howard still sits on death row. All of the criticism and fallout from these cases has isolated Hayne and West from the powerful institutions that once embraced them. They rose up together and are now falling together, although West's descent began a bit sooner and followed a steeper arc. West still reveres Hayne. He has regularly described him as one of the smartest men he knows. Both saw themselves as victims of unjust persecution, perpetrated mainly by Project Innocence. West stopped doing bite mark analyses in 2006. He gave up his private dental practice in 2009 to work for the South Mississippi Correctional Institution near Leakesville. When West's brother died in February 2016, he called Hayne and told him, "Well, it's official. You are my number one friend now." Some of their enablers have hit hard times, too. Ed Peters, a longtime former district attorney who frequently used Hayne and was among his most vocal defenders, Peters helped lead the charge to oust Emily Ward, was caught up in a statewide bribery scandal. Peters escaped formal charges by striking a deal to cooperate against others. In recent years, Forrest Allgood has been chastised by two courts for prosecutorial misconduct. In the November 2015 elections, he was finally defeated at the polls. Scott Colomb, a 32-year-old black criminal defense attorney, beat Allgood by 54% to 46%. Colomb ran on a platform of ending mass incarceration and finding alternatives to prison for nonviolent drug offenders. Allgood had been in office for 29 years. Life has been better for Jim Hood. In 2014, Hood's fellow attorneys general elected him president of the National Association of Attorneys General. Hood has also received national press for taking on corporate heavyweights like State Farm, Google, and Facebook. He continues to be one of the few Democrats to win statewide elections in the Deep South, largely as a result of his tough-on-crime positions and enthusiasm for the death penalty. In 2015, he was comfortably re-elected to his fourth term by over 10 percentage points. He is frequently mentioned as a potential candidate for governor. Eddie Lee Howard, Jimmy Duncan, Jeff Havard, and Devin Bennett all remain on death row. "I can talk for a while, but I gotta go to work pretty soon," says Kennedy Brewer. It's early afternoon in early 2015, but at 3 p.m. he needs to begin his shift at the chicken plant in Brooksville. Now 45, he's wearing his trademark stocking cap and leaning up against his prized possession, the one thing to which he treated himself with his wrongful conviction money. It's a late-model Mercury Grand Marquis. It's parked under a carport next to his house, just down the road from his mother and his sister. When Brooks and Brewer were first released, Mississippi did not yet have a law to compensate the wrongly convicted. So when Brewer was released on bail in 2007, a family friend got him a job at the chicken plant. The state finally passed a compensation bill in 2009. It provides for an annual payment of $50,000 for each year of wrongful imprisonment, with a cap at $500,000. All things considered, the payout seems paltry, and the payments stop once the exoneree passes away. The benefit isn't heritable. To receive compensation, the wrongly convicted must also agree not to sue the state. Brewer and Brooks sued Hain and West as private citizens. The money is helpful, but Brewer says he'll never quit his job at the plant. "I work because I want to," he says. Already a quiet man, Brewer's time on death row made him more solitary still. "I'd watch TV and write letters," he says. "You're in a one-man cell. You get 1 hour outside a week. You think a lot. I just spent a lot of time praying the truth would come out." Brewer has a son, 25, and a daughter, 26. When asked what he missed most about his life, after mentioning his kids, Brewer says, "Real food and cold beer." For his first meal as a free man, he went to Cracker Barrel. Neither Brooks nor Brewer ever knew Justin Johnson, though both knew of him. In February 2012, Brooks and Brewer rode together to attend his sentencing hearing. Brewer initially planned to ask that Johnson be given the death penalty. Brooks talked him out of it. He cited Johnson's untreated mental illness. "I told Kenny that after all that happened to us, we should be merciful," Brooks says. "There was no point in being mad anymore." Johnson pleaded guilty to both crimes. At the sentencing hearing, he told District Court Judge Lee Howard, "I wasn't in my right mind when I did it." Howard sentenced him to 2 terms of life without parole. "I don't hate him now," Brewer says, referring to Johnson, "but I do feel bad for him." Forrest Allgood has never apologized to Brewer. Neither have any of the state officials involved in his prosecution. Despite Justin Johnson's confession that he committed both crimes alone, Allgood still insists that Brewer had something to do with Christine Jackson's death. So does Michael West. When asked what he'd say to Allgood, West, or Hain if he had the chance, Brewer draws a slow smile. "I really don't know what I'd say. I'm glad Allgood is gone, but I ain't mad at any of them anymore. The system's gonna do what the system's gonna do." This has been a Hachette Audio production of The Cadaver King and the Country Dentist, a true story of injustice in the American South, written by Radley Balco and Tucker Carrington, with a foreword by John Grisham. Read by Robert Fass. Produced and directed by Christine M. Farrell. Recorded by Pavel Rivera and Michelle Figueroa. Post-production by Gabino Reyes. The Cadaver King and the Country Dentist is also available in print and digital formats from Public Affairs, an imprint of Perseus Books, LLC, a subsidiary of Hachette Book Group. For more Hachette Audio productions, visit us at hachetteaudio.com. Thank you for listening. Text copyright 2018 by Radley Balco and Tucker Carrington. Audio production copyright 2018, Hachette Audio, all rights reserved. Hachette Book Group supports the right to free expression and the value of copyright. The purpose of copyright is to encourage writers and artists to produce the creative works that enrich our culture. The duplicating, uploading, and distribution of this book without permission is a theft of the author's intellectual property. If you would like permission to use material from the book, other than for review purposes, please contact permissions@hbgusa.com. Thank you for your support of the author's rights.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.